And now, the weekend. Stand-up comic Paula Poundstone is coming to the Tower Theater in Fresno on Saturday. You may know her as a panelist on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but did you know she loves exercise? When it's over. And she's even written a book on happiness. Well, sort of. FM89's news director Alice Daniel recently caught up with Poundstone.
Welcome to Valley Edition, Paula. Before we get to your stand-up show in Fresno on Saturday, let's talk Wait, Wait. Is it as fun as it seems? Do you prepare for it at all?
I do. First of all, yes, it's a blast. I sit in a chair and think of things that might be funny, and I say them, along with other people who are doing the same. It's very fun. I do prepare in that I look at the news ahead of time and the bluff story we write ahead of time. But outside of that, I mean, I don't prepare jokes. There's nothing stopping me from doing that. I guess I'm just not responsible enough.
Well, your humor is so deadpan, and you don't laugh at your own jokes. And I wonder, how do you do that?
Because I do, quite honestly.
Do you?
Yeah. Not always, but sometimes. Sometimes things just strike me, I think of something quickly, and I laugh at it because I thought it was funny, too. But not always. Sometimes.
So if you were alone on a deserted island, would you be able to entertain yourself with a monologue, or do you need an audience?
No, I would need an audience. You know, if I was alone on a desert island, the first 2 days would go great. First 2 days would be fantastic. It would be a dream come true. But by the third day, I would miss my best friend, who is the audience.
Okay, so you'd have a break for 2 days, and then you'd go downhill.
Yeah, exactly. Rapidly, it would be, my gosh.
So if you hadn't made it as a comic, what would you be doing now?
I'm not sure I'd be alive, but if I was alive, I'd be an incredibly good table busser.
So would you say comedy saved you then? You said you're not sure you would be alive.
I think that it is a very, I mean, not from anything in particular other than deep depression, it's a very uplifting, healing practice. It just is. I know from audience members who come up and talk to me that it has that effect on them as an audience. And certainly, being in a room full of people who've come out to laugh for the night is, just the best job ever.
Well, in 2017, you released your second book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And mm-hmm. you were a guinea pig in a series of thoroughly unscientific experiments. What did you learn? And do you think much about happiness?
Well, I do. I mean, it's occurring to me recently that I'm not sure where anybody ever got the idea that you were supposed to be, happy, like some huge percentage of the time. I mean, it just doesn't seem that's how, it's like what your mother used to say, it's just not how life is designed, which is there's a good deal of struggle involved on every level. Struggle to sort of survive physically, hence, a job and that sort of thing. Put food on the table if you have a table. And then there's the, the relationship part, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I did find out through my experiments, physical exercise is really important. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of it every day. Here's the problem with rigorous physical exercise. It really does make you feel better. Here's the trick. It doesn't make you feel better while you're doing it.
Right.
Which is why it's this very elusive, form of emotional well-being. Because the truth is, while you're doing it, it really sucks.
Right.
It's
especially
awful.
Like if you're running. That's horrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't run. I really can. I work out. In fact, I started working out with this Taekwondo self-defense guy. I started doing it for the purposes of researching for my book. And then when I was done with that experiment, I quit because I had to go on to the next experiment and I had to isolate the variables. But years later, I went back to the guy and I've been with them ever since. And yesterday I did, I don't even know how many push-ups, and today I'm sore and stiff, but I, at the same time, I have an elevated glow about me. It's like the two things don't go together. You're either sore because you never move, or you're sore because you moved. Those are your two choices. I opt for the second.
So the takeaway from your book is laugh a lot and exercise, knowing that at some point you'll reap the benefits.
Those are two important things, I think. There are others, mm-hmm. but those are two important things. And frankly, I was hoping to dispel it. I really didn't want the answer to be physical exercise. I mean, is there anything more smug than a blonde woman in yoga pants? No.
So let's turn to your stand-up show that's coming to Fresno. You compare it to an arcade game where you stand inside a booth and they blow money around. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's sort of what the inside of my brain is like, I think. You know those arcade games where you stand inside a glass booth and they blow paper money around you, and whatever you can catch, you can keep. And I feel like that's sort of how my brain is. You know, I've been doing this job for 41 years, so I have somewhere rattling around in my brain. There is, in fact, 41 years of material. I don't really know what I'm going to say when. They're probably on a given night, about a third of what I say on a good night, and I like to think some are, probably about a third of what I say is unique to just that night. I've never said it before, and I'll never say it again. It just had to do with the interaction with the crowd that night. But my favorite part of the night is the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? I like talking to the audience, and I ask individuals questions. And from there, I really let that be the thing that sets my sails. So it may be that in that moment, there's a piece of material flying around in the glass booth, and I grab it in my brain and say that piece of material from somewhere within that 41 years. And it's just as possible that, I say stuff that, I don't know, just occurred to me in that moment. Like any conversation you have, I mean, we repeat things all the time. We say things from, that we've said before. Sometimes we say them to the same person, unfortunately. But in conversation, we repeat stories, and then we say stuff that, that's new, and then we say stuff that talks about current events. You know, that's sort of my act as a big conversation.
So it's not a bad way to operate in the world as long as funny things keep coming in. Does your mind ever go blank?
Yes.
And what do you do then?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, as I say, I got 41 years of material somewhere. I mean, I have, but there are times where, I just stand there for a second and I'm like, uh-oh. And usually given a few more seconds, I pick up the tools and keep going. But there are here and there moments where I'm just like, I got no idea what to say right now.
So when did you first know you were funny?
Well, the first sentence of the last paragraph of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher in May of 1965 says, I've enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities. So I have to assume that in May of 1965, I was doing, a tight five on Plato or something. I have that letter still.
I was going to ask you.
I do have that letter, and I also have it enlarged and framed. In addition to the fact that, I can still recall really enjoying the response of laughter when I was little, or enjoying just hearing laughter, even if it had nothing to do with me at all. It definitely influenced me, I think, that an adult liked something that I did. But I think one of the things about Mrs. Bump's letter was there was no qualifications to it. It was just that she had enjoyed it.
That's something, it's good to carry something like that with you your whole life.
It is kind of nice. And then you think about, the shit things that teachers have said to you in your lifetime, too.
Of course.
Or that people who influence you or people that you looked up to have said. And, of course, no life can bat 1,000.
Right. There's plenty of those. So one last question.
Well, I was also a pain in the neck in school, but in kindergarten, I had just gotten started.
So as a woman, what advice would you give to young women trying to break into the stand-up comedy world?
Pay as little attention to the fact that you're a woman as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a genderless job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are jobs where you could argue, you know, like tennis, you know, maybe the women shouldn't play against the men. Maybe that would be an unfair, maybe men have, you know, some sort of possibility of muscular development that women don't have. I'm not certain. Billie Jean King did, you know, who did she play? I can't even think now. Bobby Riggs. But, you know, being a woman in comedy should neither hold you back nor move you forward. You should just be a good comic. I was, years ago, California was lucky enough to have two women senators. We still do. We have Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. But years ago, for the first time we ever had two women senators, it was Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. And I'm a big admirer of both of those senators, but they did during that election, during that campaign, they both used to flit around the stage talking about the year of the woman, which always troubled me. And I told Barbara Boxer so. I'm not sure she understood why I objected to it, but I just, you know, the idea that women get a year is just silly, the year of the woman. I don't want a year. I don't want a Tuesday afternoon. I just want equality, and then we don't have to talk about it all the time. It's just there.
Well, that's a good way to end this interview. Paula Poundstone performs at the Tower Theater this Saturday at 7:30. Thanks so much for joining us, Paula.
Thanks a lot. It was nice talking with you.
You too. Take care.